So good afternoon. My name is Truth Pham, and today I'll be talking about the role of human and animal influenza surveillance and its role in providing ecological and evolutionary insights into influenza and pandemic preparedness in the One Health Initiative. So just as a brief overview, we'll be discussing the different types of influenza surveillance and emphasizing opportunities to make disease inferences based on the current nature of the surveillance system, but also highlighting limitations in these disease inferences that can only be addressed by moving towards a more hypothesis-driven surveillance system. These are my disclosures. So the rapid evolution of influenza A viruses, coupled with the increasing interactions between humans and animals, poses a public health threat to all affected species. So although influenza viruses originate and are maintained in wild migratory birds, interspecies transmissions to domestic animals, mammals, and humans do occur globally and provide opportunities for novel genotypes to emerge with pandemic potential. Examples of this include that novel H1N1 strain that emerged from swine hosts and resulted in the 2009 pandemic, and also the highly pathogenic H5N1 strain that currently circulates in both poultry and in wild birds and has caused both human disease and mortality. So the One Health Initiative was developed in order to resolve or address some of these issues. It's a global strategy aimed at understanding the comprehensive health involving both humans, animals, and the environment, and is a fundamental concept for influenza outbreak control, biosecurity, and pandemic preparedness. This is evidenced by the collaboration between national and international public health agencies that have developed a global surveillance program in order to understand the risk of circulating influenza strains and the pandemic risk imposed by new strains that emerge. These multiple agencies have also instituted policies to nurture data sharing and collaboration. And as a result, research into the ecology and evolution of influenza is an example of one of the largest One Health research initiatives that are currently underway. So despite these expansive surveillance efforts, new animal origin strains are often only recognized after human infection. For example, the recent H7N9 outbreak, and is largely due to haphazard and opportunistic surveillance efforts. Influenza surveillance efforts are primarily driven by two objectives. The first is identifying circulating strains. This is often accomplished by systematic surveillance, and samples are collected regardless of symptomatic features. The second objective is detecting viruses in response to human or animal disease. This is usually accomplished by passive surveillance in response to an outbreak, and is much more cost-effective than active surveillance, which is much more expensive. So despite the fact that these two strategies are extremely complementary, they're rarely employed in concert. As a result, this makes disease assessment very difficult because it subjects it to sampling biases and also hinders comparisons between collected data sets. And as a result, disease and risk assessment is difficult to accomplish. So currently, influenza surveillance is designed around the prevailing theory that the wild migratory duck, which is right here, is the originary maintenance reservoir for influenza viruses, and is also placed at the center of influenza's transmission ecology. As a result, much of influenza surveillance efforts are focused on recovering viruses from this host species, and that is used to inform public health prevention and control efforts. Evidence of these efforts can be seen in how surveillance is collected between different hosts and even different ecological systems. So for example, human surveillance is currently surveyed using passive surveillance techniques with the objective of monitoring for circulating seasonal strains. The advantage is that epidemiological factors and demographic factors are collected. However, usually only severe symptomatic cases are reported, and reporting is usually inconsistent across regions. In contrast, surveillance within wild animals, or wild birds specifically, is usually active with the objective of recovering viruses. The reason is because the wild birds are considered the maintenance reservoirs for influenza. They're placed at the center of influenza's transmission ecology, and also a large number of cases are asymptomatic. Because both cases and non-cases are collected, prevalence information can be calculated. However, it is extremely labor-intensive, and as a result, usually only certain species in certain regions or certain demographics are collected, with known high prevalences are collected. Surveillance within domestic animals is usually passive. However, some active surveillance does occur, for example, in some domestic animal markets, with the objective of detecting specific subtypes that have caused human or animal disease. The benefit is that it targets those interactions that have close human associations and can also detect those subtypes that have high risk of becoming pandemic. The downfall, however, is that only specific subtypes that are a public health threat are usually reported. And also the different types and different numbers of animal species that are involved in these animal markets and their role in the disease etiology is unknown. So influenza surveillance efforts have drastically increased in both human and animal surveillance within the last recent decades. These have been triggered by three primary factors. The first is a 1997 H5N1 human outbreak that occurred in Hong Kong and caused fear of a pandemic. The second is advancements in biotechnology. And the third is the reduced cost of genomic sequencing. I would like to mention also that a lot of these sequences that have been uploaded into systems such as GenBank are a result of public health policies and collaborations that have been put in place. And a lot of these sequences aren't even published upon. So what can we do with the surveillance data that's collected? So we can use information about the virus, the host, and the environment that's collected in surveillance in order to provide insights into disease dynamics, particularly those processes that are cryptic or less obvious. And we can do this with techniques such as disease modeling. Given the current nature of influenza surveillance, questions that we can currently ask are, for example, what and when was the origin of the pathogen? What was its circulation history before detection? And how has the pathogen's population structure changed over time? However, there is a great deal of inference that we make in disease modeling because we don't have a lot of very good information about prevalence, immune factors, and other factors that affect disease dynamics because currently our surveillance system for influenza is designed around recovering viruses rather than answering specific research questions. And as a result, a lot of this information is not currently collected. As scientists, however, there are inherent questions that we'd like to ask about the disease in order to learn more about it. Here's a list of some of those questions, although this is not an exhaustive list by any means. Nevertheless, these are questions that are important for us to answer in order to help us describe disease in order to inform public health prevention control efforts. So as I mentioned, the genetic data that's collected for surveillance can provide very useful information about influenza's disease dynamics. So given the fact that influenza has a high mutation rate, that it has a short generation time, it has a rapid spread, and it infects a large number of individuals across all different types of hosts, this means that we can observe influenza's ecological, evolutionary, and epidemiological processes all in real time. Now these are interdependent processes that interact in very dynamic and complex ways in order to shape disease dynamics. So some of the things that we can model using this given information is viral origins, population ancestry, evolution, spread, transmission, etc. So these are things that we can model using that concept, and we can estimate and reconstruct the virus's evolutionary history and how these processes have shaped it. These models are extremely suited for multiple types of information. However, because it is dependent upon collected data, our inferences are limited by the quantity and quality of the surveillance data that's collected. So a pathogen's evolutionary history is strongly influenced by a host's ecological and epidemiological factors. As a result, the pathogen's history can provide numerous insights in how a disease has emerged, spread, and persisted over time. So these are examples of three different phylogenies or evolutionary histories for influenza based on different types of hosts and on different types of ecotypes. So here, For seasonal human influenza, for example, H3N2, the phylogeny is strongly characterized by a ladder-like trend here. That's also directional, and this is primarily driven by host immunity. In contrast, in avian influenza found in wild birds, the phylogeny is characterized by strong spatial structuring or geospatial structuring, and also by a lot of genetic diversity. Avian influenza and domestic poultry, however, are characterized by these clustering of numerous tips with very short branches that are indicative of outbreaks. These clustering groups are usually preceded by long branches that are indicative of missing surveillance data that we don't have. So there are numerous factors that can affect disease dynamics. These are just a couple of those factors. So taking into account that there are numerous factors that can affect disease dynamics and evolution, I pose this question. Is it appropriate to include the wild migratory bird at the center of influenza's transmission ecology? Rather, we propose an alternative hypothesis, which focuses more on ecosystem dynamics and the interactions both within and between these systems in shaping the diversity of the circulating strains that we see, and then also how they affect the emergence of novel strains with pandemic potential. So now we're going to provide an example of how we can use this genetic surveillance data in order to make disease inferences about influenza, specifically avian influenza H9. So avian influenza H9 is a subtype that's found in both avian ecosystems. Within domestic systems, it's endemic in terrestrial poultry, such as chickens, and is found in multiple countries. In wild systems, it's detected in wild birds globally, and you may have heard the numerous outbreaks caused by H9N2. H9 is currently on the WHO's watch list as a possible pandemic candidate because it has been transmitted into humans and has caused disease. However, the role of ecological dynamics and geographic spread on H9 diversity is not well characterized. Here I provide a map of the global distribution surveillance data for both wild and domestic birds for H9. So what we did was we combined the genetic data along with geographical and ecological data derived from surveillance in order to model H9's migration and transmission patterns over time. So this figure shows the estimated H9 phylogeny over time, and branches are colored by estimated ancestral geographic regions. And the lines are also thickened by estimated ecotype of the ancestor, where the thick lines are suggestive of a wild ancestor and the thin lines are suggestive of a domestic bird ancestor. So here's a map of what we can derive from that phylogenetic tree. So what our results suggest is that wild birds may play a role in the long distance dispersion of H9 into new locations where it can be introduced into domestic poultry. What we see in our model is that the vast majority of the migration events that we modeled showed short distance migration between poultry to poultry and may be suggestive of the role of poultry trade in the short distance migration or localized migration transmission patterns of poultry once it's introduced from wild birds. So this table shows the migration rates that are estimated between each of the ecosystems and geographic locations that we included in our disease model. So this is a very complex table, as you can see, and actually it's slightly cut off at the end there. However, not all of these transition events have a high probability of being supported or occurring. So this is the same table, however, these are the transition events in our model that were statistically supported. What our results suggest is that H9 transmission from wild birds into domestic birds occurs both between regions and within regions. Here we can see that our model suggests that H9 transmissions from domestic birds into wild birds, first of all, does occur, and second of all, it appears to be restricted to only within regions. So this is a scatter plot of migration rates for each of our model simulations. There's about, I believe, 10,000 points on there. So what this graph shows is that for the vast majority of our model estimates, migration rates between domestic into domestic poultry or within domestic regions appear to migrate much faster than from wild into wild birds. And this may be suggestive of the role of artificial transportation in poultry trade. Likewise, these domestic to domestic transitions were estimated to be much faster than any other ecotype or ecosystem interactions, including wild to wild, wild to domestic, and domestic into wild transitions. So in summary, surveillance data can be extremely valuable in allowing us to explore the impact of ecological and epidemiological factors on disease dynamics, particularly for those disease models that are widespread and complex, such as influenza. Currently, influenza surveillance is a mixture of both passive and active collection efforts with the primary goal of recovering viruses. However, collection efforts may not be equal across different populations and demographics, and as a result, our data repositories may not be representative of what is actually circulating in nature. This poses sampling biases and limitations for disease inferences that utilize such data, and as a result, it can also confound disease detection and control efforts. So a lot of these issues may be resolved by moving towards a more hypothesis-driven surveillance system as an alternative, in which the primary goal is to answer specific research questions rather than just recover viruses. These studies can be designed with the goal of generalizability of the results in mind. It can also be designed to include both cases and non-cases so that we can calculate such epidemiological factors as prevalence and incidence. Also, we can include associated epidemiological and ecological factors so that we can have a more comprehensive idea of how to characterize and assess our diseases. It also allows the evaluation of high-risk factors and populations for risk assessment, control, and pandemic preparedness. So I'd also like to acknowledge our collaborators at MIT who helped with our H9 research and analyses. So I guess I'll take any questions that you guys have.
Thank you.
We have time for a couple questions.
None?
Oh, no, you don't get away that easy. Go ahead, Jim.
Yes, so this, so these techniques, the disease modeling techniques, can be used to look at the effectiveness of vaccine, especially in its role in the evolution of influenza viruses or quickly evolving viruses. With H9, however, especially because it's endemic in many developing countries, we don't have very good information about that. If we did have good information about that, that would definitely be a variable or a factor that we could include in our disease model. Did I answer your question? Okay. Yes, sir.
So I agree that this is very important to understand the evolution of the viruses and the different host species. But I think from just from a response point of view, we usually try to leverage the resources to the perceive in return on the investment that we do that. Have to worry about the other disease, not just the avian influenza. And I think the argument that you're presenting here, although it is great and strong and it's really reasonable, but it can be strengthened a little bit further. You can add to it some type of evidence that this approach is actually going to provide better return on the investment rather than just using the current.
I agree. And perhaps perhaps an argument would be that much of the human disease the influenza strains that emerge in humans and that have pandemic potential have emerged through a lot of interactions between humans and animals, specifically swine and chickens and domestic poultry. So we know that that interaction is extremely important in perhaps shaping the way that these pandemic threats may emerge. And so that is personally my argument. And also, we also know that a lot of these pandemic strains have jumped between wild birds into domestic birds also. But if you don't incorporate these interactions into your disease model or even into your surveillance system, you're going to miss it. And because the surveillance data is so important and how we model the disease in even descriptive epidemiology, if we don't have the information, our disease models is only as good as our data.
Absolutely, absolutely. But at the end, like as I'm speaking from strictly from the response point of view, I mean, if I am sitting in my lab at university doing some research, I won't do things that they're not necessarily important in the response, but they're of other value in the future that we can. So my point is that we in the response, especially the response, which is basically what surveillance, disease surveillance are designed for, is to manage perceived level of risk.
Right.
And if that perceived level of risk is not high enough, even though, yes, we know that there is that risk, that it is going to happen, we know that it has happened, and it has happened with others. As one of the speakers mentioned, you know, Ebola now is perfect. Somewhere in the north country, and they're like, okay, we just have to bury our heads in the sand. But so the risk is there, no one can resist that. But how much of risk is there to justify, you know, changing the approach and using different methods of surveillance? That exactly is the question.
Right. And like I said, I can absolutely agree because it is an allocation of financial resources. But however, if I may provide the example of the recent H1N1 pandemic, many people didn't think that it could reemerge as a pandemic. However, you know, if surveillance efforts were comprehensive enough, we could probably have detected that, or we included all these different factors. And I completely understand that, you know, influenza may or may not be a priority depending on the different outbreaks that have emerged. For example, you know, the Ebola outbreak and it's kind of the hierarchy of that. But yes.
Okay, let's thank you.